You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games, the player who played them and the gamers who gained them. My name is Ran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello!
And today we have an interesting topic, an unusual topic. We're talking about maps, but we want to use them in order to create new stuff. We want to scale our game using their scale.
Your gaming session begins. The GM describes your party entering into a room with her raspy voice. She places a map on the table. The map displays the room along with its various antique furniture, the work table laden with potions, and the chair where the count, who smells faintly of apples, sits and waits for you to consider his generous offer. Okay, that was a great start for a gaming session. And there are so many things in that short description we could talk about. But what I want to spend this episode focused on is not only one thing, but one single aspect of that thing. And I'm talking about the map. The map that the GM places on the table. And to be more precise, I want to talk about the scale of that map. Try to imagine that same session opening, but this time the map that the GM places on the table is of the entire floor where the meeting takes place. This is already a subtle hint, a foreshadowing that there is more to this encounter than a mere conversation with the count. If the GM would place a map of a city, for example, and simply indicate with her finger in which building the conversation takes place, we immediately understand that this adventure is bigger, way bigger than just a conversation with the count about a specific offer. Most likely the whole city would be involved in this endeavor. And my thesis for this whole episode is that the scale of the map we are using to map out our adventure is influencing both how we as GM perceive the game and how our player would perceive it, regardless if there's an actual physical map on the table or whether this is a virtual map that we need to keep track of in our mind as we progress in our adventure. Now, in this episode, we will look at some scales and how they might affect the way that we look at the game.
You see, maps not only show you different scales, like a map of a world or a map of a city or a map of a dungeon level, they also help you think in those scales. It's a common thing for maps to follow adventures. That is, you create an adventure and then you create a map for it. But sometimes it could be the other way around. Sometimes you can use a map in order to create an adventure because it will help you think about specific scales.
Let us begin with what I think is the basic and most important distinction, and that is a room, a floor, and a building. Now, limiting the scale makes for a more focused interaction. When I design a room for an adventure, I think about interactions. I think about interaction with the objects in the room. I think about interactions with NPCs that might be in a room or any other creature. I imagine character inside that really confined space. Confined in the, not in the sense that it's necessarily small. The room could be a grand ballroom for that matter.
But it has limits.
It has very clearly defined limits. Mm. It is confined to these walls, to these sections which comprise the room. This is where the scene will take place. Once I step back and expand that scale, I'm looking at the floor. It's a series of rooms, probably connected by hallways, maybe have other features. And I start to think, what is the logic of this floor? What is the functionality of these rooms and how do they interact with the grander scheme of this location? If this is a floor of a military base, I would imagine guard posts. I would place them in the entrance and the exits. If this is a bank, I would have a section dedicated for audience coming in, and I would have a different section dedicated for counting money or handle transaction. I would place management offices, etc., etc. You start thinking in concepts rather than in specifics.
This is the difference between an orc guarding a chest in a room, and why is it an orc when you look about the entire level of the dungeon? Why specifically an orc? Why are there orcs here? And why is he guarding a treasure chest in this room? What's the reason that there's treasure in this room?
If we take another step back and enlarge our perspective even more, we think of a building, a series of floors which comprised of rooms and hallways. And now we start thinking about topography. We start thinking of story events. And we start thinking, where would I place these events and spread them out throughout the structure in order to encourage the character to explore more of this wonderful building? I now have to think of, how do we progress from one floor to another? Where are the points of connection, and how to place them in ways that would maximize the exposure of this building and these floors to the player characters. A very interesting thing to think about is if you have ever been in a shopping mall. Now, shopping malls have a few amazing tricks in their topography. For example, most of them would allow you to go up very easily. The stairways leading up would usually be closer to the entrances, but a lot of time you would have to go around a certain section to get to the next stairway. Or if you want to take the route downward after you climbed up, you need to take a longer route. This whole point of this topography is to get you to walk around more. If you have ever been to a convenience store, you would notice that the most selling items, the most common items, are usually way at the back. The bread, the milk, the cereal boxes, whatever it is that people usually go in to buy. You place them far at the end so that people would have to walk the length of the shop in order to get to them, and thereby they spend A, more time at the shop, B, have to go past other shelves with other products that might catch their eye, and therefore they will build more. This is exactly the difference between planning a building and planning a floor. The floor plans of a convenience store are designed to maximize the chances that you will buy more than you wanted to.
In a dungeon, when you have several levels, again comes the question of why. I mean, if all of them are just random rooms that have nothing in common, might as well all be in the same level. And also, why would that even exist? A level needs to have an explanation for its denizens. And dungeon needs to have an explanation for its existence. Why is this place here? What was here before? Who created this place? Who was here before the current denizens, if any? Why are there various monsters around? And there should be, of course, various interesting challenges, as Uri said before, because we want players to explore and find out various nice things that we've placed for them. And so probably not everyone should be an orc. Why? Why are there other things here? What brought them here in the first place? The next step, after we've finished with the building, is the city. And this is a very different scale. Once you move to the scale of a city, once you look at a city map, you're no longer actually looking at an adventure. You're looking at maybe the reasons for an adventure. You're looking at the people. Because a city, while being big, is still a place of importance for the individual. Because when you look at a map of a city, you think about, where's the blacksmith? Where I can go there and fix my armor. Where's the noble houses? I can go there and get a new adventure. I think of myself. I think of the specific person that lives in a specific place and serves me in some way. Because I'm an adventurer and I'm in the city, they need to serve me. But for a GM, you also think about a lot of other things, like, for example, where it's proper to go. Like, there are neighborhoods where it is fine and expected of you to be there, but there are neighborhoods, like, for example, the noble manors, where you are not expected to be, and you shouldn't go there. There are places where it's dangerous, like in the docks, and you shouldn't go there. I mean, it's all a map. You look at it and it's from afar, you know, from the scale of the person who just looks at the map, just see a lot of houses. But these houses tell a story of places where it's dangerous, where there are people who are in need, where there are people of different statuses. And when you once you look at all of this, you start to ask yourself, why? Who needs what? Who needs money? Who needs recognition or acceptance? What are the desires? Again, because it's a personal thing, what are the personal desires of people who live here? And you can already start thinking about the next level, the continent level. You think about a reflection of that greater nature of things. For example, who the city belongs to? What are the customs that they will demand of such a city? Is it a small city, a big city? Does it have a specific industry that is the reason for its existence? Is it under threat? Who in the city feels what? Who is an immigrant and feels like they don't belong? There's so much going on in this map if you read it in the mind of a person who is looking for conflict, that you can probably create a gazillion things out of any city that you look at, as long as you know what to look for. On the continent level, we're now moving to the political scale, and we've reached far beyond the room, the simple room, because now we're looking at social groups. I don't want to say nations, because nation is just a specific way for people to exist, but there are many different types of social constructs. And more importantly, in the continent level, these social facts are hundreds of years old. They have such large scale conflicts between them, and they are so slow moving that we are looking at an organism that is, it will take hundreds of years for things to change again, probably.
I think the word you're looking for is history.
Yes.
Their history, both in the past and in the making, and that just takes a lot of time.
Very true, very true. And the conflicts between nations, although they are slow moving, they are made of many parts, and there are many attacks on many fronts. Now, if you look, for example, at a horde of barbarians about to assault a port city on the continent level, the city is a small thing, and that horde is a small thing. What about the war chief of the hordes? What about the army of the kingdom that protects the city? What brought them to where they are now? What is the horde attacking now? Why haven't they attacked 70 generations ago? What is the status of the army? Why does this kingdom has an army? How big is it? But even more than that, when I say attack on many fronts, I mean, for example, using assassins, using political maneuvers to maneuver a different party, a third party in this conflict, to do something else entirely, and so shift the balance. We're talking about trade wars. There are so many things that can happen on the political map, and all of them can become a reason for changes in the cities, which can become a reason for changes in buildings, etc., etc. But then we move on to the largest scale, and we talk about the multiverse.
Largest?
I think
perhaps.
So. When you look at the map of the multiverse, you're looking at the planes of existence. You're talking about the ontological truths about the nature of the supernatural in this setting. Talking about the voyage of the soul, the seat of the gods, where different types of energies come from, etc., etc. And these are important for several reasons. First of all, I really like this. I really enjoy knowing what the ontological truth of my universe is. And so I like browsing
maybe
them.
Maybe because it's so lacking in the real world we live in.
True. But second, this will dictate things for the next level, as every other level dictated for the level below it. So, for example, if we have a heaven and a hell and they are fighting each other, but they can't fight on the material plane because they are barred from entering it directly, then they will find a way to install agents, maybe through dreams or maybe portals or stuff like that, into the continent level where nations that are in some way beholden to either heaven or hell fight each other. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we go down level after level.
Remember our party just stepping into the room, talking with the count? Now, they know they're in a floor. They know they're in a building. They know that that building is in a city. They know that the city resides in a continent, and that continent is presumably in a multiverse of some sort. But does it matter? If the answer is yes, there should be a map of that as well, be it physical or virtual in the mind of the GM. If it doesn't matter, maybe all we need is, you know, an old napkin with a few lines scratched on it, and maybe some doodling of a chair and a table and a character.
Nice. I would like to claim that most campaigns, most classical campaigns of role-playing games that are D&D-esque, go through this layer of scales almost directly from the bottom to the top. I mean, everything begins with a single scene at a single place. And eventually, at level 20, you will find the reason for something that went off in the ontological sense, in the larger scale of things, that initiated the change in the continent, that initiated the change in the city, etc., etc., that created the thing, the reason for you to be in the tomb in the first place. Almost all adventure paths of Paizo, for example, follow this scale, and I think it's great. For games in which you are expected to advance in levels and advance in power, in, you know, from such scales, from level 1 to 20, you can barely even, when you're level 20, you can barely even remember how things were at level 1. You're so much more powerful. It only stands to reason that the scale of the things that you do shift as well, and that the map, as you say, I really like it, Yuri, in your mind of the importance of things, and will remain there as a guide for you. And whenever you go up a level, whenever you realize, I'm looking at a city now, it also makes you as a player feel awesome, because that power comes into effect in the game. You are now affecting a city. You no longer need to clear a dungeon. Now your actions will have consequences over tens of thousands of people. You see the map in your mind.
Mm-hmm. There's also something very important to note, that a lot of adventures, or if we considered other mediums, comic movies, etc., where there is a default map. For Batman, the map is a map of the city. Batman is in Gotham City. That's where he's at. That's the default scale of that universe.
True.
If you would, of most narratives, shall we say. If you look at several books, for example, you can see how the scale changes throughout. As we were writing down the notes for this episode, I was thinking of books I've read and movies I've seen, and I realized that in many of them, there was an implied scale from the very beginning. If you've read Dragonlance, you never start with an actual single room. The kind of default scale is a continent, and it really leads you there.
Well, they show you a map of the continent to begin with.
To be very literal in that sense, yeah. But in other works, sometimes you don't have a map, because this is the adventures of this specific group, and they go places, but the places aren't as important as the group. I'm talking about the kind of books that if you would have a map at their end, it would be a map of the various characters and the interaction between them, and not of the places they've been or the scales of what they've done. Because that's not the heart of the matter.
Finally, we should say something about maps of events, because we've talked about scale of spaces, but time is like the other twin of space-time, and it's just as important. Now, we won't spend a lot of time on it because a lot of time. We won't spend a lot.
I just got it.
Now, we won't spend a lot of time on it because we can do an entire episode just on this. But it is important to note that there are, for example, maps of events in which you show which events connect to which events in the order that players are expected to follow. Scenes connected to scenes. I would like to bring as an example the iceberg model from City of Mist. It's something that Amit codified in the game, and you actually see it as an iceberg. You begin with Death Zero, which is the tip of the iceberg, the thing that we see from above. That's how the case begins. All of City of Mist is about solving cases, mystery cases. It begins with the tip of the iceberg, but most of it, of course, is under the surface. It's depth 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the lower you go, the more closer you get to the literal truth and supernatural truth of things. That's why it's called the iceberg model. And the way that it is framed in the book is by showing you scenes. Like, for example, in Death 1, you will have location A, location B, scene A. Scene can be something like someone calls you. It's something that will happen. It's a scene that the GM can start whenever they feel like it's time for it. But it will always happen at Death 1. That is, only when we started the investigation, only when we got to a place where we still don't know a lot. And these locations connect to locations in the next death. And the only way to get to that death is through them. Now, I say locations, so it sounds as if I'm talking about spaces, but actually I'm talking about events. First of all, because the distance between the location has no matter at all. And second of all, because we're talking about scenes that happen in this location and the order of these scenes. First, we will have scenes that happen in depth one, and only then we will have scenes that happen at location at depth two, and so on going down. And all of these are connected until you get down to the final scene, which was, in a way, the originator of everything. So that's one way of doing it. There are, of course, other ways.
It's also called a narrative game, narrative design, because you design a sequence of events that generate a narrative rather than a simulated game,
yes,
where you simulate a world and the characters do whatever they want with it. There is also the famous principle of the Schrödinger's dungeon, meaning I want to have this specific event, this event being an ambush by goblins. So I would tell my players, okay, you can turn north to the forest of Evergreen, or you can turn south to the dungeon of Darkmoor. And if they would say, let's head north, then there will be a goblin ambush in the forest. And if they say, no, let us head south, then there will be a goblin ambush at the swamps. It's Schrödinger's dungeons. It's there and it's not until you go there, and then whatever you want to happen, happen. In many cases, it's a lot easier to plan an adventure by a map of events. However, I will remind you that the first rule of running any role-playing game is that you will not run your game the way you planned it.
Sure, but that is also true for the other type of adventure design that we just talked about. Like, for example, if I create a gazillion different personalities and places in my city, the adventurers will choose to go to place gazillion and one, and I will have to create it on the spot or something
like that. Gazillion and one, and then they will open a tavern there, and then sure, they won't understand why they have to go and rescue the Crystal of Oblivion from the famous Dark Lord.
Of course.
Don't get me started.
So in any case, of course, there is a different way of for you to prepare for each of these different cases. But in any case, things will go wrong. And we have enough, I think, episodes that talk about it on our podcast. It's called On the Shadow of Dwarves. You could check it out at dwarfcast.net.
But you digress.
But yes, I do. Let's summarize, Uri.
In summary, your adventure, whether you thought about it or not, have a scale, a universal scale, in much the same way that a map has a scale for its size. Your adventure has a scale for its relevance. How your adventure affects the world around it. Does it affect this room and the people in it? Does it affect the whole floor in which it takes place? Is this whole building a part of this story? Is this city influenced by the event that's going to happen to this group of PCs? Is this continent in danger? Is the multiverse about to be saved or ruined based on the actions of these players and their characters? Maybe. Keeping that scale in your mind and broadcasting that scale to your players, so they would be aware of the stakes and the significance of what they do, impact every single scene that you will run in this game.
Indeed, it's very much a part of setting expectations. Where this will go, how big this will get, etc. I personally, however, I do like all of this episode exactly from the other side. I like it as the GM who sees the map and then has to think about what does this mean for my adventure instead of the other way around. So many ways to do this, but if you want to do it yourself and tell us how you did it, excellent. Send us an email to show@dwarfcast.net or check out Facebook, Twitter, @dwarfpodcast, where we there exist and can do the chattings with you. If you want us to talk about your topic, no problem at all. If you have a question, excellent. However, please do note in the email if we can discuss it on air and if there are any secrets in it, what we should not probably say. Also, if we can say your name. Not everyone wants us to say their name. That's fair. That's fair. And now it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of dwarves.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games in our personal lives. Uri, you have a big thing.
Yesterday, I was in a convention. It was called Beyond the Screen Convention. It was a different role-play convention than what you might imagine. A fellow named Aviad Tal, he is a great guy, he's a great GM, and he has a YouTube channel called Beyond the Screen. There is a link in the show notes. Go and watch. He organized this convention. This is the second time this convention is run, and this is a TED-like convention, meaning there are about six GMs, each prepare a 15 to 20 minutes lecture about one element that they want to talk about. And it was a great success, mainly because a few days ago, we also had a meeting of all the lecturers. I was at one of the lecturers, by the way. I talked about my approach to creating adventures, the dichotomy of creating a setup, a build-up, and the payoff in order to get emotional responses from your players. A few days ago, we had a meeting of all the lecturers, every single one of them a great GM, and we spent hours talking about each other's lectures and suggesting new ideas, and it really reminded me how awesome it is to simply sit down with a bunch of people and talk about role-playing games, not in the sense that we exchange stories about our sessions and how great it was, but to discuss in depth the mechanics and the ideas and ways of improving our games and other people's games and fine-tuning concepts and methods in order to get to a better experience, in order to do what we do as GMs better. Like I said, it was an amazing event in many, many different levels. When I look at the convention, I think, did I have a chance to meet new people? And I did. Did I learn something new? And I did. I learned something new from every single lecture, including my own. Was it inspiring for me and for other people to make ourselves better GM? And I think the answer was a resounding yes for all of those. Definitely we'll go again and we'll try to promote this as much as I can.
We should note it was in Hebrew.
Yep.
However, it will be uploaded. It's supposed to be uploaded to YouTube. So those of you in the audience that are able to listen to Hebrew and understand it, you will be more than welcome to follow the link in the show notes to Aviad Tal's YouTube channel. Well, I'm going to assume it's maybe already up by the time you're listening to this.
Another thing is that I think gaming conventions are by definition focused on the gaming. And a lot of time what you see in a convention is games. And it's so refreshing to see a convention dedicated to improvement and for discussion. Not as a side dish, not as something that you might want to listen if you have an empty slot between games.
No, but more like an academic thing, like a theorycraft, really focusing on the act and not acting.
It was a professional convention. You came there because you wanted to get value, not necessarily entertainment.
Awesome.
You wanted to get specific practical information to make your GMing skill better and to make your game better.
Awesome.
And I feel this is what we're trying to do with this podcast. And it's so nice to see another manifestation of that same will and desire.
Very much true. I myself have nothing more to add, and therefore we will now end the entire podcast. I mean, this episode. We will probably have another one next week. That's what we do.
Later on!
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution and non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo, and you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.